Dads on the air, we're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. We are bringing you today an important conversation on a topic of vital importance to many men and boys. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and with me in the studio today is Ken Thompson.
Hi, Bill, and hello to everybody listening.
Now, our guest today is Mark Griffiths, who is the chair of SAMHSN. SAMHSN stands for Survivors and Mates Support Network. Mark Griffiths is a registered psychologist and a member of the Australian Psychological Society. Mark has a history of working as a senior psychologist in sexual assault services, originally at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital, the Central Sydney Area Health Service at Newtown and Redfern. He is now working in his own practice and is the chairperson of SAMHSN's advisory board. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
It's a great pleasure. Now, Mark, SAMHSN, as I mentioned, it stands for Survivors and Mates Support Network. Is that a description of what SAMHSN provides to men in our community?
Yes, it is. It's an excellent description of what they do, because the guys that started SAMHSN as an organisation were part of the acknowledgement that men who have been abused as children can get an enormous amount of support from other men who were in a similar situation. So it sort of complements any counselling or other assistance that male survivors can get.
And I understand it was set up in 2010. You've been made chairman since the original setup, I take it?
After I was involved with SAMHSN, beginning to run some groups with them, that was when I was asked to be chair of the Clinical Advisory Board. So I'm not chair of SAMHSN, just the Clinical Advisory Board.
Mark, after all these years of working in this area of sexual assault of men, do you feel a bit worn out?
No, almost the opposite, really, because I see the work that I'm involved in as having enormous potential to support and help men recover. So I get my jollies, I suppose you could say, out of seeing male survivors recover. However, that's not to say that, like all other clinicians working in this area, I don't have to take care of myself so that I don't get overwhelmed by listening to other people's trauma and sharing that empathically with them. The technical term for that nowadays is vicarious traumatization, and anybody working in this field certainly needs to take care of themselves so that that doesn't get to them.
Yes, and I imagine the success stories would be very satisfying, but is healing possible? When men have been through these terrible experiences, is it something that they can hope that they will completely heal?
Absolutely, but we need to be careful about what our definition of healing is. Something that I find really useful when talking to people that have been abused is that if you're thinking of it as a physical injury that happens to you, it's easier to understand that, you know, the physical injury can repair, you can recover from it, but you might always have a bit of a limp or a bit of a scar to show what happened. And I think that's very much the same for psychological injury, which is what happens to people when they've been physically, emotionally, or sexually abused as children.
And do men have particular issues? I mean, it's terrible that any child would be abused in this way, but are there special issues for men that go through this experience?
There certainly are, and a lot of it seems to tie up with men appearing to be more vulnerable to shame around what has happened to them. But the way that emerges for men is that it's not at all unusual, in fact it's almost the norm, for men who have been sexually abused as children to experience some point some confusion around their sexual orientation. So you'll get men, that, particularly straight guys, a bit confused about the abuse, particularly if it was from another male, that confusion around, did that make me gay, or was that gay sex, or was I gay at the time? And unfortunately, that particular problem is made worse because in the community, there's still a lot of people have the mistaken belief that a man who sexually abuses boys or young teenagers is gay. My response to that is to say, well, if a guy was abusing a young girl, would that make him heterosexual? No, it would make him a child abuser. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, a lot of guys carry on carrying that that confusion, and unfortunately, the community reinforces that. Men also get confused about their masculinity, which of course is different from sexual orientation. So that would come down to people often saying things like, well, what sort of a man am I that would let something like that happen to me? And of course, the obvious answer to that is, well, you weren't a man, you were a child, you were a boy, and probably very confused about what was going on at the time.
Yes, there is this social expectation that men are expected to be in control all the time, and I suppose in this situation where the child has no control, it makes it doubly difficult to deal with it.
Absolutely, because it's stuff that the community puts on men, those, you know, gender expectations, but it's also stuff that they put on themselves. And again, as I said, it's missing the reality that when it happened to them, they were, you know, a young teenager or a child. But I suppose one of the things that makes it most difficult for men, firstly, to disclose what happened to them, and secondly, to acknowledge and ask for some support, is the general myth, also alive and well in the community, that if a boy is sexually abused, he will automatically grow up to be a perpetrator. And that's a myth. It's something that we're challenging all the time. And when we talk about it with men, either in individual counselling or when they're in the groups, it comes as an immense relief to them to have some information around that simply is a myth, that there may be instances where men who were abused as children have gone on to be perpetrators themselves, but the reality is the vast majority do not.
I imagine that would be a further worry for these victims, that they might not trust themselves even with their own children because of that sort of rumour.
You're absolutely correct there. It's one of the saddest things you can hear from men who've been abused to talk about the fear they've had of changing their baby's nappies, for instance, because someone might think they're being inappropriate. So it's one of those examples where the sexual abuse of someone can start to interrupt the relationship they have with their own children, so that, you know, a dad who might want to give his children a cuddle and a kiss and do all that sort of close physical play can get awkward, embarrassed and reluctant to have those sorts of physical contacts with their children because of those concerns that other people might be suspicious that they're being inappropriate.
I suppose that can affect the other partner as well. The other partner becomes maybe hypervigilant to the fact that could take place as well, and that could affect the overall relationship between two people.
Absolutely. Sadly, that is the case. And as I said, that it's a myth that is alive and well in the community. So the partners who are members of the community, obviously, may well have that misinformation and be suspicious around their male partner's interactions with children. So it's an important myth to expose because it really is one of the things that makes it most difficult for men to deal with what's happened to them.
And we're speaking with Mark Griffiths, who is a consultant psychologist and the chair of Samson's Advisory Board. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back in a moment.
When you're down and troubled and you need a helping hand and nothing, well, nothing's going right, close your eyes and think of me, and soon I will be there to brighten up even your darkest night. You just call up my name, and you know wherever I am, I'll come running, oh yeah, baby, to see you again. Winter, spring, summer, or fall, now all you got to do is call, and I'll be there, yeah, yeah, yeah. You've got a friend. If the sky above you should turn dark and full of clouds, and that old north wind should begin to blow, keep your head together and call my name out loud now. Soon I'll be knocking upon your door. You just call up my name, and you know wherever I am, I'll come running, oh yes I will, see you again. Winter, spring, summer, all you got to do is call, and I'll be there, yeah, yeah, yeah. You've got a friend.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
And that was James Taylor singing You've Got a Friend. And our guest today is Mark Griffiths, consultant psychologist and chair of Samson's Advisory Board. Mark, we were just speaking about the secondary effects on victims of this sexual assault as a child. Sometimes they carry this for a long time. I've seen that sometimes it might even go on average of 20 years before they talk to anybody about what happened.
Yes, that's certainly the case, and certainly the evidence that's emerging from the Royal Commission that's currently running. The Royal Commission has pointed out that they've had men in their 60s and similar ages talking about this is the first opportunity at the Royal Commission to talk about what happened to them. They haven't felt safe to do so before, and some of them hadn't even disclosed to anybody, including their partners. So it's a measure, really, of how difficult the secrecy around abuse is for men to deal with, and how long they can feel they have to carry that. And of course the sad irony here is that it was never their secret anyway. The secret belongs to the perpetrator, and victims, male or female, are usually tricked into keeping that secret, and that trickery and encouragement to keep the perpetrator's secret is part of what we call grooming.
So why do you think these men have been prepared to open up at the Royal Commission? I mean, if they've kept it quiet for 20 years, why do they suddenly feel that they're able to tell the world effectively?
I think they feel that they can start talking about it simply because the community has started talking about it. The first man I ever spoke to who identified child sexual abuse as the issue he wanted to discuss in counselling was in 1991. Now, really, that's not that long ago. So it's really since the beginning of the rise in the feminist movement, with people starting to talk about the abuse of women and children in the 80s, that finally men started to feel safe to talk about it. And it really comes down to one simple word, and that's safety. And I think what we've now got is an environment where people feel safer about talking about the sexual abuse they experienced as children, and to finally feel that someone is going to listen to them and to believe them. So I think you could understand how important that would be for someone who hasn't felt they've been able to feel someone would listen and believe, that finally there's a Royal Commission with eminent judges and an enormous staff and an investigatory role. The Royal Commission is willing and interested in hearing from them what happened and how it's affected them.
Yes, one of the tragedies of this area is when a child does report it, sometimes he gets into more trouble. So it's a vicious circle, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, I mean, some of the stories I've heard from people, you know, frankly bizarre in the way that sometimes adults have responded, like, you know, punishing the child for saying something so awful about such a nice person, for instance.
Mm.
And a child having told a responsible adult, you would think and hope that would be of an assistance to them, but sadly it isn't always.
And these are very powerful institutions that are being dealt with at the Royal Commission, and the Catholic Church being just one of them. It's very hard for one small individual to take on a powerful body like that, I'm sure.
Absolutely. The organisations have been shown by the Royal Commission to have at times have a lot more interest in covering their own and defending their own reputations and even the perpetrators than taking care of the children that have been abused.
Yeah.
Particularly some of the serial perpetrators, that is people who perpetrate against a large number of children, they're incredibly expert at grooming the child to keep the secret, but they're also expert at grooming other people, including adults, to not respond appropriately, to believe that in spite of, you know, evidence to the contrary, that they are a safe person, and all the stories about them doing, you know, nasty things to children is just children being naughty and telling lies.
Mark, we hear a lot about male perpetrators, but there's been a few cases recently regarding female perpetrators, and that seems to be becoming more of an issue. Have you had experience with that, and is it as widespread as perhaps we're now beginning to hear about?
The research literature would indicate that for a female to be abused by another female is actually quite unusual. However, for a male to be abused by a female is somewhat more common, and the literature would indicate that about 10 to 12% of male victims would have been perpetrated against by a female, either on her own or in cooperation with a male. So with the groups that we run, which would always contain a maximum of 12 men, there's nearly always one or two of them in the group who were abused by a female. So that then, of course, brings up specific issues for them. And, you know, a lot of them come to the group wondering, well, was it really abuse if the person that abused me was a female?
Mm. Now, Mark, unfortunately, your group, SAMHSA, is unfunded by the government, but you have a website, and for people that want to help in the wonderful work you're doing, can you just tell us the website that they should go to?
Yes, www.samhsa.org.au. And I should just point out that we do get an enormous amount of support from New South Wales Attorney Generals and Justice, in that for men who were offended against in New South Wales, because it's a state program, men offended against in New South Wales are able to come to the SAMHSA groups, and victim services will pick up the tab for that. So we do get that support, and I should also point out that victim services are able to pay for people to get one-to-one counselling as well if that offence occurred in New South Wales, where they are in the process slowly of trying to get an agreement between similar bodies in the other states so that at least there'll be no restrictions across the country for people where the offence may not have occurred in the state in which they're currently living, but that hasn't happened yet as I understand it.
So that's a bit of good news. And don't forget, SAMHSA is spelled S-A-M-S-N. It stands for Survivors and Mate Support Network. Now, Mark Griffiths, we always ask our guests to pick a song when we get towards the end of the interview. I wonder if you could tell us which song you've picked and why you picked it.
It's a Tom Waits song. I've long been a lover of his song and his music. The haunting song that starts at the beginning of The Wire is of course, a Tom Waits song. Why I chose What's Become of All the Little Boys, it's pretty obvious. We, for instance, at present, we're looking at the Royal Commission. A lot of the attention is on the perpetrators. A lot of the attention is on the organisations that haven't done a very good job of taking care of the victims. So I think it just sort of leaves the question hanging in the air for the males that have been abused, you know, what's become of all the little boys?
Okay, well, this song is On the Nickel by Tom Waits from his 1985 album Heart Attack and Vine.
Sticks and stones will break my bones. Always will be true. And when your mama's dead and gone, I'll sing this lullaby just for you. What becomes of all the little boys? Who never comb their hair. They line up all around the block on the nickel. Becomes for the little boys. They never say their prayers. Sleeping like a baby on the nickel. Yeah.
And that was Tom Waits singing On the Nickel. We'd like to especially thank our guest today, Mark Griffiths, consultant psychologist and chair of Samson's Advisory Board. Thank you for being on the program. It's a difficult subject to discuss, but you've really enlightened us on many aspects of it, and we thank you very much for being on the program.
That's terrific. Thanks for having me on, guys.
And we'll be back next week. Don't forget, if you'd like to listen to this program again or any of our shows, go to dadsontheair.com.au and send us an email and we'll be in touch.